This is Writing It, the podcast about academics and writing. I'm Rachel Gordon. Here, we aim to make the process of writing and publishing a bit more transparent and a bit less overwhelming. Through conversations with editors and academics at all stages, from full professors to graduate students, independent scholars, and postdocs, we share stories, lessons, and helpful habits from our writing lives. So we're really delighted today to get to speak with Nina Caputo and Liz Clark. Nina Caputo is an associate professor in the Department of History here at the University of Florida. She's a scholar of medieval Jewish history and interfaith relations in medieval Europe. She has taught at the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Michigan, and Florida International University, and has been a recipient of a Mellon Foundation Fellowship and a Dorst Fellowship at the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies. She is the author of Nachmanides in Medieval Catalonia, History, Community, Messianism, and Debating Truth, The Barcelona Disputation of 1263, A Graphic History, which was illustrated by Liz Clark, which is why we have both author and scholar and illustrator with us here today. Liz Clark, the illustrator, lives in Cape Town, where she works as an illustrator. She's contributed to the genre of graphic history internationally, and her work is featured in 7 books published by Oxford University Press. And I wonder, Nina, if you could start by telling us how this came about, that you two worked together on Debating Truth, this graphic history by Oxford.
Yeah, of course. Actually, I came to discover this series at Oxford through my colleague, Ronald Schechter. We were together on a fellowship in Oxford, and he appeared one day in October with this amazing book in hand and said, look, my comic book is out. My graphic history is out. And I'm like, what is that? And his book was called Mendoza the Jew, and it was also illustrated by Liz. And I looked at it, and it was this kind of amazing innovation that allowed this story, a really interesting story about this Jewish boxer in 18th and 19th century England, to be laid out both in text and in illustrated form, in comic book form. And I was taken by it, and I sat down with him, and he said, well, I'll put you in touch with my editor, because I immediately had an idea of what I wanted to work on. I got in touch with the editor at Oxford, and he then, after lots of back and forth and discussion about how this might look, he put me in touch with Liz, who had, as I said, already done two or three of those graphic histories for Oxford University Press.
And so when you said you already had an idea, was this topic something you were thinking of writing in your regular historian way, or?
Well, I had actually already written about it as, it formed a discussion of this event of the Barcelona Disputation was a chapter in my book. I had been working on it for a long time. It's a fascinating kind of moment in history, but also a bit of textual evidence. And it seemed perfect for the genre. And, looking back on it, if I had ever imagined that someone would make a comic book or a graphic history out of a theological debate, it just seems mad. But it works well. And what we did was we actually did 2 perspectives. We brought it from we sort of told the story twice, once from the Jewish perspective and once from the Christian perspective, which was a way of kind of breaking down the difficulty of dealing with two very similar but different texts.
So for you, this came about in large part because of this wonderful serendipitous meeting with this other author of one of these books.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. It would never have occurred to me. Yeah.
And I know actually many people who use your graphic history in their Intro to Judaism classes have loved using it. Liz, on your end, how does this work? How do you become involved and how do you select which works you're going to be part of, if it is the case that an editor presents these ideas to you?
The editor will contact me and say he's been in touch with an author, he's got an interesting idea, and then he'll put us in touch with each other and we'll start discussing it, and we'll put together a book proposal with a few pages of graphic history to show what the art's going to look like, and if that's successful, we go ahead with the whole book.
And for you, what are you thinking about when you're deciding if it's a project you want to work on?
I think one of the great things about working on the series has been the variety of subject matter. It's very interesting for me. But I think you can tell if something is going to be a good story visually or not. Just what is the story about and sort of lend themselves more to being visual stories or not. I think that the editor often will have already weeded out ones that clearly aren't going to have the visual component that's really going to work. Yeah, I think generally when something is brought to me, it's got a lot of potential. And yeah, I can see that it's going to make a good graphic history.
Can you say more about this visual component in case our listeners are thinking, I think I have an idea for a graphic history. What should they be looking for, checking to kind of vet it in their own mind, whether it might work?
I think it's surprising sometimes what things do work visually. I've done some things which seem very based in text, and they worked really well. I guess that when I say does it work visually, I'm thinking more in terms of a narrative. You know, is it going to be able to adapt into a narrative structure that's going to make a good graphic history? Rather than that it has to be something that you immediately go, oh, this is sort of cinematic, or, you know, just straight off. We can usually make that work anyway.
So does that mean you're thinking from the start, I can imagine panels, individual scenes? Is that what you're thinking about?
I think that you can see that it's going to make a good story, that it's going to start somewhere and move somewhere. And it's often good if it's focused on people that you know are going to make good characters, because you are now dealing with a story, even though obviously it's factual. Yeah, but you know, it is going to fit in the medium of comic books.
Right. So did you two work together in terms of figuring out what these pictures would be, what the text beside the pictures would be? How did that work in terms of figuring that out, Nina?
Well, it was actually, this is the first time I've actually ever seen Liz, because we worked entirely on email. So it's very nice to meet you, Liz, or at least to see you, even if you can't see me. And essentially what we did was, the first thing Liz asked me was about physical attributes. And most of the characters that appeared in my book, we do not know anything about their physical attributes. We know a little bit about what the king may have looked like, and perhaps what a couple of the other characters may have looked like. But Nachmanides, we know nothing about. We don't know anything about the friars. And so it was kind of, what qualities do you want this person to have? How do you want this person to look? How do you want this person to stand? You know, what kind of clothing should this person wear? And for me, this meant going into a kind of research that I'd never done in terms of textiles, representations of people, how people comported themselves, what Jews wore, what Christians wore, you know, what colors were popular at the time. So all these things are things that I, as an intellectual historian, I never ever thought about or dealt with. And so the first thing that Liz did was ask me to come up with some of these kind of characteristics. And she basically sketched out the main characters and gave me a couple of different options to choose from. And we used those as kind of characters so she gave me three and I chose one of those three. And some of the questions that came up, would Nachmanides have had a beard? And, you know, we decided to give him a short, very sort of modest beard rather than a long beard or no beard, even though both of those could have been options, because that was the, you know, in terms of the popular, the way that people comported themselves at his sort of social class in the time and place, that seemed appropriate. It was both in observance of Jewish law and kind of right for the place. And so these were some of the questions that we came up with. And in each case, as we plotted out the story over the long term, I would send her basically pages, how the pages should be laid out, how many cells would be on each page, what the text would be. And as we went through, you know, she kind of goaded me away from my tendency to dump large amounts of text into each panel. And I think by the end, I was being much more kind of conservative about what I said. But initially, I was very, very wedded to the text as it appeared. So I would send her the layout of the page. I would sketch it out for her. And this, you know, this is how many cells. This is where I want Nachmanides to be standing. This is kind of the palette that I would like to see. And then she would get it back to me. And the first round would be rough drawings in pencil. And then they would be later inked once we figured out exactly how we wanted it to look.
Yeah. So that really is very collaborative. And Liz, I'm guessing with the amount of text, this must have been just partly based on your experience with graphic history. What is your sense of sort of how much text really works in these, or how do you try to get a writer? What are you telling them to get it down to so that it's the right amount?
Yeah, I think there's just a practical issue of how much space there is on a page, for one thing. And you've got to think about pacing. So yeah, it's generally, you know, be concise, you know, the core of what's being said. And I think that because of the space issue, people who are used to writing for other mediums don't always think about, you know, maybe you've got some little words in there that aren't really contributing to meaning, and even cutting one of those is going to help. So yeah, that's something that I can sort of just remind authors about, that every word is valuable in a medium like this.
Yeah. So if listeners, again, are interested in writing this kind of history, Oxford series is actually the only one I'm aware of, although it probably isn't the only one from an academic press, I'm not sure. But it sounds like they'd need to pitch it to that editor at Oxford, and then it seems like you are the go-to illustrator for the project.
There are others. Okay. I've done most of the books in the series, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And are you aware, is this something that do they want scholars who have at least one, quote, regular book, academic book published, or what do you think the series or the editors at Oxford are looking for?
I think they're looking for people who have a good story to tell. Most of the people who have done it have been relatively senior or have been in the field for a while, but I think they are just looking for things that would communicate an idea well. And many of these, if not all of them, deal with some kind of marginal population, sort of because it gives an opportunity to visualize something that might not be easily represented in historical images. The first one, Abina, it just went into a third edition, I think. So that one has been the most successful. And I think that there's been a little bit of, they're not as keen to just jump into it any longer, because I think none of the others has been as successful as that one. I may be wrong, but that's my sense.
And when you say successful, is this a matter of prizes or sales? What are you thinking of?
I think sales. I think, you know, I think ultimately it's been used by lots of people who don't know anything about African history and who want to put something that's substantial into their class. And so the latest edition, I think, has got other scholars contributing to it in addition to the initial author, but I haven't seen it yet. I just got an ad for it. But it actually fits into a number of different kinds of curricula, whereas I think that debating truth is more specialized. You know, it's going to go only into specific kinds of classes.
Mm-hmm. And Liz, from your perspective or your interaction with the editors, do you have any insights into what the editors might be looking for from prospective authors or pitches?
Right, I don't really. I think, the series is quite well established now. I think that they probably have a fairly good idea of what to explore and what to just reject immediately. But I don't know what they're actually looking for at present.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wonder for each of you why this work, you know, why being part of this kind of collaborative book is fun and meaningful and worth the time in your career. Liz, let me just start with you. Why do you choose to do this kind of illustration?
I find it really interesting. I get to learn a bit of history each time. You know, these are never subjects that I know anything about. I didn't study history, but it's personally interesting. And as an artist, there are interesting challenges that come with it. Sometimes working within constraints actually can be more rewarding. So sometimes when you are dealing with something that isn't an obvious subject for art, that can actually allow you to be more creative in some ways. Yeah, it's just a very interesting, varied job to do.
Do you feel like you're teaching historians or scholars something about the visual? I would imagine for many academics, they're not used to thinking about that.
Yeah, I think it varies from author to author. Some of them have come with a greater knowledge of comics and graphic novels than others. But I think it's always a very collaborative process. So yeah, they're teaching me things, I'm teaching them things.
That's great. And Nina, what about for you?
I definitely learned an amazing amount from Liz, because as someone who never actually read comic books as a child, and have limited experience, and only since I started working on this project in graphic histories or graphic narratives, it was kind of a deep plunge into an unknown world. And so talking, when she was telling me about pacing and how to make a page actually communicate in the most effective way, how to make the reader want to turn the page for the rest of the story, I learned a lot about not only about the graphic medium, but I also about how a story should be told. Like what are the components? How do you kind of lay out a narrative for people who don't have necessarily any commitment to that narrative? What is it that you need? And, you know, I've known something about that. I read a lot of books and I write a lot, but I hadn't thought about it in that way. And so that was something that I learned a lot from the way that this was kind of the way that the collaboration worked. I had to put this together, and I was also translating the text as we went because I did a new translation. So I would spend the evening translating and then sort of figuring out how I wanted the text that I translated put into the graphic. And so it was, you know, it was very much a learning process as I went.
When you say learning about how to make the reader want to turn the page, which I agree is something that we scholars are not always used to thinking about, did that entail thinking about building in suspense, or what, practically speaking, were you trying to add?
You know, I was trying to think about how to make the characters appealing or at least sympathetic. And so since we do it from both perspectives, once from the Jewish perspective, once from the Christian perspective, part of what I wanted to do was to make the reader identify with the characters in different ways in those two different parts of the text. You know, I don't have any real control over how a prose book unfolds in terms of where the pages get turned, but in this you really do. Like, you really have a sense of how the palette changes, how, you know, the shadows on the characters' faces change, what the lighting is in the background, what the room might have felt like or looked like. And so those things have an impact on the way that the graphic unfolds.
Yeah. Liz, I wonder if that means, are you helping writers figure out what to bring out more or accentuate in character or story? What do you do to help authors like Nina figure out how to make this more of a page turner?
I think that, again, that will be a bit different from script to script, that, you know, some of them we will work on a script more, sort of develop it, and others, the author will be quite confident about what they're doing and they'll deliver me a very finished script. I think that a lot of what I do probably comes in more as I start to sketch, and we can then discuss how it's translating into images and make changes where we need to then.
I also wondered if either of you had heard much about the reception or how this book has been received and used. Liz, do you hear back from readers or teachers?
I occasionally hear nice things, but I think usually they'll be getting in touch with the author rather than me.
And Nina?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a number of colleagues have said that they use it and they enjoy using it and the students enjoy it. You know, I'm using it this semester in my class, and it's a little bit awkward teaching your own book. But it's also, you know, it's the only one like that out there. So it seems like it's a good thing to do. But yeah, so I have heard from a number of people who say they really like using it.
That's great. I also wonder, Nina, about how this book factors into tenure and promotion. Many listeners will wonder, does this count? What's happened in your case?
Well, it varies from person to person. My colleague Jennifer Riad, who wrote on Perpetua, also working with Liz in classics, she was promoted to full on the basis of her book. I gave me a slight bump in my salary and nothing else. So it depends on the department TMP regulations, at least at this university. Mm-hmm. In my department, it didn't count as a research project. So I'm still glad I did it. Right. It would have been nice if I'd been promoted on it, but
is that something, I mean, do you think that scholars can advocate for more? Is there a way, do you think, to make the case for this counting?
Again, I think it really depends on the institution and on the department. I mean, I think, again, in a department that has, for example, original translation as a promotable product, then it's perfectly fine. In my department, it needs to be an academic book with an academic press. And so I got the second part, but this is counted as a textbook, which does not actually lead to promotion in my department. I think it really varies. And I guess it depends on what the university is trying to accomplish with tenure and promotion. I mean, I think if they're looking for this, by far, this book has reached more people than anything else I've written, right? There's no way that even a fraction of the people who have looked at this have looked at anything else I've written. And so, you know, in that respect, it should be rewarded. But it really depends on the department and the university and what they are kind of rewarding for.
Some of our listeners have wondered if when an academic chooses one of these more creative types of books or projects, does it lead to other kinds of possibilities or invitations or collaborations or projects? Nina did this book.
No, I mean, I've had a lot of people ask if I'm going to do another one. And you know, I think that I've got some things that I would love to play with, but they're not in my field and they're not sort of my expertise. I've had a number of opportunities to speak about this in public, which have been wonderful, a lot of different kinds of settings. And so that's been great. And even though I've been working on the disputation for a long time, I have not been called upon to sort of speak about it specifically because it was part of a bigger project. So that's been great. But no, I have not had any other kind of creative endeavors come my way.
Did it make you think about doing different things than you think you might have had you not done this project?
You know, for a moment, I thought about writing a regular textbook, and then I decided, no, that's not something I want to do. But no, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this was just, it was kind of a very serendipitous thing, and it was kind of a labor of love. I didn't think I would get promoted on it. I just really enjoyed it, and I think that this is a really useful story to tell for understanding Jewish-Christian relations in the Middle Ages and the complexities of those relations, which, you know, tend to be stereotyped as always, you know, Jews being persecuted and Jews having stumbling blocks put in front of them in terms of achieving what they need to achieve. And this, I think this case is a unique example where it's much more complicated. So I think it's useful for that. And I think, you know, I think it's kind of a fun story. It's like this sort of heroic story.
Definitely. Yeah. Liz, I'm wondering if listeners are thinking about graphic histories, is this generally the process wherein they do not need to know an illustrator themselves? They should probably look for presses that do this, and then the press takes care of the finding the illustrator or matching them. Do you know if that's how it generally works?
It works both ways. I think actually, yeah, I mean, quite often I think that you'll get an author-illustrator pair coming to a publisher, but obviously for me it has generally been through the press, although I have been contacted directly by authors and collaborated with them without coming through a press. So yeah, in my experience, it's usually that the author will be paired up with an illustrator by the publisher, but it does work both ways.
Great. There is a couple of questions we ask most guests, and one of them is about if there's something we usually ask, is there something you wish you had known earlier in your career about writing or publishing, since we are focused on writing and publishing? So for Liz, I wonder, just in your experience with academics who might be thinking about this kind of graphic history, you know, is there something you can tell it would be good for them to have realized this or to know this sort of earlier if they were thinking about doing a graphic history?
I think that the main thing with most of the authors is just getting the hang of how much space you have for the words, and that you do have to change your writing style a little bit. And it is about the pictures. Only thing also that authors sometimes have to adjust to is remembering that the pictures are also communicating directly to the reader. And you don't need the words in the pictures to be saying the same thing twice. Mm. And they can actually work together and support each other to create a complete message. Mm-hmm. So learning to do that can be a little bit of a learning curve for some authors.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Nina, I wonder if there's something more broadly about writing or publishing that you realized, gee, this would have been helpful to know earlier in my academic career.
God, I can't really think of it. I mean, in terms of writing this book, the thing that I wish I had known in the process of the project was, now I'm completely forgetting the name of the book, but Matthew McLeod's What is Comics? Is that right? What are comics?
Scott McLeod.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. I'm forgetting the title and the author, which it's was
Understanding Comics, I think.
Yes. Understanding Comics, right. When I found it, it was kind of an amazing experience because it actually kind of told me, along with what Lisbeth had been helping me with, how comics work, how people read them, because I really hadn't been trained in how to read a comic. And that's part of what I like to do when I teach also, when I teach this book. It's like, how do you read this? Mm-hmm. And so had I known that before I went into this, I think that the process at the very beginning would have been very different. And I think that it's possible that the book might have been less compact. Like I would have put less into it, if that makes sense. In terms of publishing, you know, this was an amazing experience. Working with the editor, Charles Cavalieri, was great. He was really attentive and answered lots of questions and really advocated for me and you know, immediately put me in touch with Liz, which was fantastic. I've never had that kind of experience with an editor before. And the editing of the text for the book was also pretty exceptional, because half of the book is comic, is illustrated, and half of it is text. And the editors at Oxford did a wonderful job as well. And so that was really helpful. And writing that also, you know, writing that sort of textbook style, which is not the kind of style that we write in our articles and monographs, it was a very different experience for me. Like it made me think about, you know, what does my reader bring to this? So like, I can't assume a certain base of knowledge. This is for undergraduates or high school students, or maybe even bar mitzvah kids, you know, bat mitzvah kids. It's not going to appeal to people who have a broad range of understanding of medieval history. Not to say that I dumbed it down, but I sort of had to start at really ground zero and build a foundation for it. So that was also an interesting experience, because I had never had to do that before with my work.
That's interesting what you said about the editing that you received. We've had many guests who've sort of complained or commented that at an academic press, they're really not getting much editorial. So I guess your folks there really had an eye to what works for a graphic history.
It's actually not out of their academic division. It's out of their textbook.
Oh, textbook
division.
Okay.
So yeah, they have, it's different. I think that they might have editors on staff there. Whereas, you know, they often send out academic works to, you know, freelance editors. So this is a different market. And so I think that they want to kind of address that market.
And relatedly, was the price better than most academic presses books?
Yeah, I think it's like $19,
oh, that's
$24. It's and now I think that a lot of, since so many people have assigned it for classes, it's now there's a sort of used, a whole circulating group of used copies that are available. And I think they also just released an ebook, if I'm not mistaken, which is nice to know.
Yeah, that is great. Back to the question that some listeners will wonder, when might I do this type of thing if I'm interested in doing a graphic history? It sounds like post-tenure book is likely, and then you might want to check with the department about how this will count, if it will count.
Yeah, I definitely get a sense of how this would fit into your dossier, because, you know, it is a lot of work, and it will definitely take you away. This took me away from I got onto this project during a sabbatical, and I had been planning to work on a very different project, and that whole project was waylaid by this, which was, you know, I don't regret it, but it also means that I have, you know, my timetable changed radically as a consequence.
Yeah. Some people might assume this takes a lot less time than a regular book. Maybe it does. I'm curious, how long do you each feel you spend on this graphic history? Liz, for you, how much time is it?
It depends how many pages I'm drawing. I think these ones usually be in somewhere between 6 and 8 months of work for me.
And, you know, you probably have things you have to do before it gets to the Liz stage. How long did you spend on it?
You know, I didn't have that much before I got to the Liz stage. The whole process, I think, from start to publication was about a year and a half, which is like meteor speed.
Yeah, for academics, yeah.
But it was a lot of, you know, I spent two whole summers basically doing nothing else. And I was also working on it during the academic year as well. So it meant that it took up a lot, you know, at the time that I would have been spending doing research and writing. I was focusing on this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wondering if there's anything else you want to share with listeners about this process, what it requires, what was unexpected benefits or drawbacks that might be interesting for our academic writer listeners to hear about. Liz, anything come to mind?
First, what some of the authors don't anticipate is how many questions I'm going to be asking them, and how much they're going to have to try to help me figure out what things looked like, what places and people looked like. There may or may not be records that we can use, and how much they're going to have me say, now hang on, where was that? What did that look like?
Does that mean you're asking about what would be in a home at a certain time, or what type,
yeah,
what length of skirt a woman likely would have worn then, those sort of details?
Well, definitely, you go, okay, you know, if this is inside a home, then what would an interior have looked like for that a person of that class and that background at that time in that place? You know, I need to know what the furniture looked like, and to, get things at least generally right. You know, we may not have every detail perfect, but we do want to try and get close. So yeah, there's a lot of going into what the physical space looked like and what the clothes looked like that maybe authors don't realize that I'm going to need to know.
Yeah, and does it extend to dialogue too? Are you asking authors about, is this a word or an expression that would have been used, or what kind of slang was common at the time?
I usually don't get too involved with the dialogue. I mean, if something really occurs to me as I'm reading it, then I will query them. But mm-hmm. That's not usually, I'm not usually involved at that level in the writing.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And it gets back to Nina's point about these are details that most of us scholars and even historians aren't necessarily used to paying attention to. Nina, what about from you?
I mean, Liz is absolutely correct. I was surprised at both how many questions and how canny and like right on the mark her questions were. And they were about things that I, again, never think about. You know, what kind of shoes would Nachmanides have been wearing? Like, I never thought of him as an embodied person. I always thought of him purely as text. And so this was a whole kind of shift in the way I was thinking. And that wasn't expected. I mean, both my own thinking about that and dealing, you know, sort of working with Liz, who was so attentive to this detail. You know, I've received, the other thing that's been a little bit unexpected in terms of the responses to this, I've received some negative responses also. There was one physician from Switzerland who wrote to me and was very angry that Nachmanides was not wearing a kippah and did not have long forelocks and did not have a long beard. And this just seemed absolutely, you know, unacceptable to him. Hmm. And so I had to, you know, I actually wrote one very brief message back to him saying, well, this was a decision that we made based on historical context and based on the fact that, you know, most Jews in the Middle Ages probably didn't look like the Orthodox Jews in your community. And he continued to write back to me and tell me that he did not like what I had done. Hmm. So I stopped writing with him. But you know, I have received some critical responses to the depiction. And, you know, in dealing with, that was another unexpected thing, dealing with somebody who's a really well-known sort of iconic figure who is not usually depicted generates anxiety among some readers. And so that I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. You know, Nina, another thing I was just wondering about is that, you know, I feel some listeners will wonder, is it helpful or did you find it was helpful to do a different kind of project after the normal writing that we academics tend to do? Was it a kind of break in a way?
Oh, it was definitely a break. I mean, yes, but it was a little bit difficult to come back into. And I think that my writing has changed as a consequence of not the graphic part of it, but the kind of textbook part of it. I think I've become less intent on using academies in my writing, which is not a bad thing at all. I still use it, of course, but I think that I'm a little bit more aware of it. And I think about writing as in slightly different ways. Like I really enjoy writing, but it's something that takes a lot of time. And I don't always set aside a whole day to do it anymore, which is what I used to do. And you know, when I was writing the graphic, I basically had like 2 hours after everything else I had done in the evening that I could work on this. And so I'm more comfortable doing that than I once was.
Hmm. Yeah. And that brings me to another question we usually ask guests, which is if there is a writing practice or habit that you're using that is working for you lately. Liz, I don't know if you are also a writer.
No. Okay.
And Nina, what about you?
I think that's it. Yeah. I mean, essentially I'm more comfortable. I'm trying to remove myself from this idea that I need to be focused always on this one project, focused on writing for, you know, large blocks of time, and that writing is something I can do between other things. I don't think I do it as well that way, but it's something that I can at least get started in small pieces.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that too. I really appreciate your making the time for us. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Writing It, the podcast about academics and writing, sponsored by the Center for Jewish Studies at the University of Florida. Visit our podcast description to find out how to contact us and send us your questions about academic writing and publishing. Follow us on social media at Writing It Pod and subscribe to us so you never miss an episode.